It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at President Trump's approval ratings in his first week in office and other political news with Harry Enten from 538.
First, President Trump took action on some of the immigration promises he made on the campaign trail today. In a set of executive actions, the president started the process on his signature campaign promise, building a wall between the United States and Mexico. The executive orders also cracked down on sanctuary cities and directed funds toward deporting undocumented immigrants.
The president gave a speech about immigration at the Department of Homeland Security today. Here's what he had to say.
We're in the middle of a crisis on our southern border. The unprecedented surge of illegal migrants from Central America is harming both Mexico and the United States, and I believe the steps we will take, starting right now, will improve the safety in both of our countries. Going to be very, very good for Mexico. A nation without borders is not a nation. Beginning today, the United States of America gets back control of its borders, gets back its borders.
More immigration-related moves are expected this week. Karthik Ramakrishnan joins us now. He's a professor of public policy and political science at the University of California, Riverside, and he serves as the associate dean of the School of Public Policy there. Karthik, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the wall. The president said construction would begin immediately. There are questions about funding from Congress still on that. But what are some of the challenges you see in building this wall and making it a central part of immigration control?
Well, there are two ways to think about this. One, in terms of the politics of all of this, and then thinking about this from a policy perspective. From a policy perspective, it's a bit of a head-scratcher, because for over a decade now, we've had net zero migration from Mexico, which means that there are about as many people coming to the U.S. from Mexico as people leaving to go back to Mexico. And in fact, in the last 4 years, we've had negative migration. So the problem of mass migration from Mexico is a thing of the past. And most people don't think we're going to see that ever again, unless, of course, we see economic and political dislocation in Mexico, which, ironically, the Trump administration seems to be provoking right now. So from a policy perspective, most people who study this see immigration, including undocumented immigration, as a net benefit economically to the U.S., and ironically, it has not been an issue for the last decade or so, but Trump is making good on his promise during the campaign to build a wall as a way to halt the flow of undocumented immigration to the U.S.
And the president referenced migrants there coming from Central America, and we did have a summer or two where we had a lot of young undocumented immigrants trying to cross the border into the United States. People saw that as overwhelming the system. Again, is a wall part of a policy to stop that?
Well, what the Obama administration did to try to stem that flow was, first of all, to go to some of these Central American countries. Joe Biden and others went and said, you know, it's going to be very difficult for people to process their asylum claims, so don't even bother making the journey. But we also relied more heavily on Mexico to do the enforcement internally. Trump claims that this wall is going to help Mexico do its job better when it comes to Central American migrants, but that's not where Mexico does its enforcement on Central American refugees or asylees. It does its enforcement with its southern border. It also does a lot of interior enforcement within Mexico. So it's not clear that this wall has anything to do with the Central American migration pressures.
You mentioned a few moments ago a net outflow now of migrants going more back to Mexico than coming north from Mexico. And you said the one thing that could change that was economic dislocation and turmoil in Mexico. And you said President Trump's policies could aggravate that. What did you mean?
So President Trump has been talking about either or shredding NAFTA or renegotiating NAFTA. Already there's been a pretty significant increase in the number of pesos per dollar. So there's been a significant inflation of the peso. There's a lot of economic uncertainty over jobs, especially by auto manufacturers and other manufacturers having facilities in Mexico. So we could very well see a future in which unemployment unemployment skyrockets in Mexico. And we know that when unemployment skyrockets in Mexico, there's a lot of pressure for Mexicans to come to the U.S. looking for work. So that's, I mean, more generally, what you see with Trump's declaration about needing strong borders, it's in line with a more nationalist economic policy and a more protectionist economic policy, which could lead to a lot of economic dislocation, not only in the U.S., but also in Mexico.
Karthik Ramakrishnan is with us from the University of California, Riverside, looking at President Trump's immigration announcements today, some more expected through the week. In response to this idea of this being beneficial to Mexico as well as the U.S., here's a little more of what President Trump had to say today about the idea of the wall.
This will also help Mexico by deterring illegal immigration from Central America and by disrupting violent cartel networks. As I've said repeatedly to the country, we are going to get the bad ones out.
So a big wall as a deterrent to Central American migrants who want to come through illegally and making it harder for drug cartels to smuggle drugs.
Well, if you look at the, I'm sorry, if you look at the research on this and even what the Department of Homeland Security said in the past and what the current nominee or the current head of Department of Homeland Security said, is a wall in and of itself is not going to be a deterrent because people have found ways to dig tunnels underneath walls and other means of trying to export drugs and smuggle people and weapons across the U.S.-Mexico border. So what the wall does do, and this is in line with our research, we have a book that came out a few months ago called Framing Immigrants. It sets up a very effective image in people's minds that if you put up a wall, that you're solving these problems of undocumented immigration, of human smuggling, of weapons and drug smuggling. We know that that is just an image. There are other ways that criminal enterprises find ways to come into the U.S., including using the northern border with Canada. In fact, there's prior studies which suggest that we are more vulnerable when it comes to national security from our northern border than we are with our southern border. And so this is one way to try to persuade the American public that we have control over our borders, but a lot remains to be done.
Apart from the wall, the president mentioned more funding, increasing the staff of the Border Patrol and of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, so more person power at the border itself and then enforcing immigration around the country. What do you make of that that pledge, that goal?
Part of that goal also included threats to withdraw federal grants and funding for cities and states that don't cooperate when it comes to immigration enforcement. That's going to set up a constitutional challenge. States resisted the federal government when it came to penalizing those that didn't participate in the Affordable Care Act when it came to Medicaid expansion. You're going to see some of those fights. I think what you're going to see is resistance at the state and local level in many of these places, but also uncertainty over what this will mean economically. We're in a situation where we have relatively low unemployment. So what will immigration enforcement do to the labor market in various states and localities that have low unemployment? Most likely it's going to mean significantly higher wages and disruption to local economies and societies.
The president is also likely, it sounds like this week, to cut back on the number of Syrian refugees or put a stop to Syrian refugees even entering the United States and limiting refugee immigration in the United States in general. Can you talk a bit about refugee policy?
So it looks like President Trump, first of all, is calling about a temporary halt to make sure that the refugee admissions policy is secure. It already has been known to be quite rigorous and secure in the United States as opposed to, say, countries in Europe where they have much more population pressures from refugee groups. But it also goes against what a lot of cities throughout the country. I mean, certainly you've had states, many Republican states that have said that we don't want these refugee populations. But on the other hand, you've had several states and many cities across the country that say that have said that we welcome these refugee populations and they'll be a boon to our local economies. Donald Trump is moving away from that. He's essentially cutting down on the total number of refugee admissions, especially from Syria. One estimate that I saw would essentially have the kind of commitments that President Obama had made.
Karthik, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Karthik Ramakrishnan, professor of public policy and political science at the University of California, Riverside. He's the associate dean of the School of Public Policy there. We've been talking about some of the new immigration memoranda issued by Donald Trump today.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a plan to expand a Ho-Chunk casino has some local Wisconsin tribes worried about their own communities and economies. We'll find out why.
Right now, we are in the first week of President Trump's term in the White House. Since his inauguration, he has signed several executive orders, been protested by people in the U.S. and around the world, and announced that he'll nominate his choice for the Supreme Court next week.
He also surprised many this week when he announced he would call for an investigation into what he believes was widespread voter fraud in the 2016 election.
Harry Enten is back with us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, President Trump just sworn into office last Friday, and some numbers out there about his approval ratings. Now, as I understand it, usually presidents coming in get a bump. They take some time to unify the parties and the people after the tenor of the election, and the numbers go up. What happened this time?
Well, not really. They didn't really go up for now President Trump. If you look at Gallup, for instance, the first approval rating that came out from them on Monday had his approval rating at 45%. Going all the way back to Harry Truman, no incoming president had an approval rating of less than 50%. And Trump's disapproval rating of 45% is by far and away the largest disapproval rating ever. Now, part of that may be that we have more polarization than ever in this country, at least since you and I have been alive. But a large part of that is because Donald Trump continues to be disliked by a lot of people despite winning in November.
Is that something that you see mattering to him? I mean, there are different sides to this. Will he get legislation passed by members of Congress? But also, does he defy the gravity of polls?
Well, we can look at this in a few ways. If you look at some political science literature, it suggests that when presidents are unpopular, they have a harder time getting through their preferred pieces of legislation in Congress. But it's also the case that the Congress right now is controlled by Republicans, and the next election isn't for about another 2 years. And Republicans really haven't shown much of a sign of disagreeing too much with the new president. But, you know, it could also be, again, that they may say, you know, Trump was unpopular in November and he still won, so maybe we shouldn't pay attention to this. I think Republican lawmakers are going to be looking at all these different factors. And I think at least initially they'll lean a little bit more towards giving Trump the benefit of the doubt. But if his numbers continue to be what they are in, say, 6 months or in a year, that's when I think he'll have a much more difficult time dealing with Congress.
And President Trump was protested nationwide the day after his inauguration. There were a lot of issues there, different reasons why people were marching. Trump may have been a common denominator, but there were other things as well. But how is President Trump doing polls-wise with women right now?
Well, if you look at the numbers, whether they be now or whether they be during the election, he's doing worse with women than he is with men. It's not a huge surprise, at least since 1980. Republicans tend to do worse with women voters than they do with male voters. But Trump, the gender gap that's being demonstrated, at least right now, between how Trump is doing with men and women is much wider than we normally expect. The reason he won this election was because male voters came out so strongly for him, but female voters really were against him. It was the largest gender gap on record going back as far as we have historical records since 1952 between how men and women voted. So the fact that you had a lot of women marching on Saturday really shouldn't come as that much of a surprise.
You took a look at who was out marching, and what did you find about a correlation between, were these just you Clinton voters who were out there, or were there new people coming out, maybe in different areas of the country that we might not have expected?
Well, you know, obviously we don't know who individually was out there marching, but we do know that where people were protesting tended to be in the more Clinton areas. For example, we know that about 80% of the people who were out there marching were in states that were won by both President Clinton and President Obama, or not President Clinton, Hillary Clinton, the Democratic nominee last time around. So 80% of those were from the Clinton-Obama states versus just, say, just about 20% were from states that either, well, it was just 20% that were from states that Trump won last time around. That's much different than, say, the Tea Party protests back in 2009, when they were much more well-balanced between the states that Clinton won this time around and the states that Trump won this time around. So it's really in the same areas.
Before we move on, size-wise, how did the protests compare with Tea Party protests?
They were much larger than the Tea Party protests were, by millions. You know, obviously we have to rely on measurements that may not be all that scientific, some coming from the organizers themselves, which tend to inflate how many people tend to march. But even taking that into account, we know that there were a lot more protesters, millions of protesters this time around, versus just hundreds of thousands for at least the initial round of the Tea Party protests in 2009.
We're talking with Harry Enten from 538.com, taking a look at Donald Trump's first week in office going on right now. And Harry, let's talk about executive orders right now. He signed quite a few in the first week, and the week is not over. How does what we've seen so far compare to other presidents in that first week?
Well, you know, Trump is putting his pen to paper, and I think what's so interesting about it, more than just how it compares to past presidents, is that he's really doing a lot of what he promised to do, right? He's coming in, he's trying to work on immigration, for example, which was a key hallmark of his campaign. And I think what this speaks largely to is that as a lot of the press gets distracted by certain statements that Trump has made, and distracted for good reasons, he's passing or, you know, trying to sign a legislation that he promised his supporters. And that's what the political science literature has taught us throughout, is that presidents keep their promises, and Trump is trying to keep his promises. And the fact that we're 5 days into this and we're talking about all this activity that Trump is doing suggests that he's actually doing what he said he would do. And I think that's very important, because there were a lot of people who thought perhaps Trump would be different once he got into office than when he was out on the campaign trail. But everything he's doing so far is basically what he said he would do out on the campaign trail.
So given that, would you expect to see those approval ratings start to go up among his supporters and others?
Well, you know, I think that there are a few things to keep in mind with that. Number one is the fact that Trump won the presidency despite the fact that he was the least, you know, popular major party nominee of all time. He won because Hillary Clinton was also very much disliked. So even if he holds on to his core supporters, it's no guarantee that he would still be that he would actually become more popular. He, in fact, could lose some popularity insofar as that there were a number of people who voted for him, 5, 6, 7%. Of the population as a whole voted for him, despite the fact that they did not hold a favorable view of him. So if he follows through on what he's doing or what he promised to do, in fact, it could alienate some people who voted for him. I just don't see necessarily that the connection between the two of those will hold.
Moving on to the Supreme Court, President Trump has said that he's planning to pick his Supreme Court nominee next week, Thursday. Any indication about who he's thinking about?
Well, right now it essentially looks like it's going to be one of three candidates. They're all federal court judges. They're all very conservative. William Pryor Jr. perhaps is the one that the arch conservatives would really like getting through. He's a true lightning rod. But he's probably not the favorite. Neil Gorsuch, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is actually the person that most people think he's also a federal court judge. But they're all very conservative, and there's a real question as to whether or not he's going to be able to get the 60 votes in the Senate that he would need in order to invoke cloture and get an up or down vote. And remember, Republicans only hold 52 seats right now, so getting to 60 seats could be an uphill climb for Trump, especially if he picks a conservative nominee, which it seems like he's going to pick.
Have Democrats done anything to indicate how they plan to respond to Trump's picks or what they're hoping to see?
Well, I mean, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, has essentially said that you better pick someone who's mainstream. If you don't, we're going to give you a really hard time. And Democrats, of course, are very upset because, remember, Antonin Scalia died about a year ago, and Barack Obama nominated Merrick Garland to fill that slot, and Republicans wouldn't even hold hearings. So Democrats really have no real reason to compromise right now with Republicans, and they are going to want a nominee that perhaps is more middle of the road, and if they don't get it, It could be very interesting television indeed. In fact, I think this is probably going to be the most contentious Supreme Court hearing since at least Clarence Thomas, which, of course, was primetime television, if any of you remember it.
Okay, lastly, Harry, I want to talk about voter fraud. President Trump has said that he believes that there is widespread voter fraud, and he thinks it cost him the popular vote. And following up on that, he said he's going to launch a big investigation. How do you think that's going to proceed?
Well, I think we should say, first off, there is no proof whatsoever of any widespread voter fraud. It's a conspiracy theory and one that has no basis in fact. Trump heard this from a few studies, and the authors of those studies have said Trump has misinterpreted their results. So there's no real basis for it. Now, Trump can try and, you know, get some sort of congressional investigation going, and, you know, congressional investigations are a dime a minute, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily going to go anywhere. And most of his supporters, including Mike Huckabee, who was a big Donald Trump supporter, had basically said, let's move on. There's nothing to this. And indeed, there is nothing to it. So, you know, Trump can say what he wants, but this is a clear indication where there is no proof whatsoever that any electoral fraud took place.
Meanwhile,
or at least on any widespread scale.
And it came out today, a little bit of news here, that Steve Bannon from the Trump administration is registered to vote in two states. And this is among the group of people that Trump is looking for as he looks at his into these claims of voter fraud.
Exactly, exactly. His own daughter, Tiffany Trump, was also registered in two states. A lot of people do that, but that doesn't mean they're voting in two states. And it's not, and as long as they don't vote in both states, no one, it hasn't typically been prosecuted.
And we leave it there. Harry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Harry Enten there with 538.com, where he's a senior political writer and analyst, joining us to talk about President Trump's approval rating and his first week in the White House.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out why some Wisconsin tribes are objecting to the expansion of a Ho-Chunk casino in Wittenberg. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about this year's Oscar nominees and find out what movies you think deserve an award.
First, you may have heard about plans to expand a Ho-Chunk casino facility in Wisconsin earlier last year. Those plans were facing opposition from other nearby tribes worried that the expansion would hurt their economies.
Recently, a new study that was commissioned by the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of Mohican Indians found that expanding the Ho-Chunk-Wittenberg facility could cause neighboring tribes to lose significant amounts of revenue.
Joining us now to tell us more about the study and some of the opposition to the casino expansion not far from Wausau is Dennis Puz. He's the Stockbridge-Munsee General Counsel. Dennis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what did your report find about the impact of the expansion of this, it's called an ancillary facility for this Ho-Chunk facility in Wittenberg?
Well, it found that there would be 7 tribes in total, 11 different casinos that would be impacted by this unlawful expansion of the Wittenberg facility, my client being the one most harmed, with a 37% loss, which represents $22 million of slot revenue that we would lose if that expansion continued forward.
The idea being that the casino market is generally saturated. If this new thing comes in and gets business, it would have to do that by taking business from existing casinos. Is that right?
Exactly. The Wittenberg facility is 16 miles from the Stockbridge Mohican North Star facility, and it has a superior location on 29 and 45 main thoroughfares and highways in the state, and it's that much closer to the main population center of Marathon County.
How much economic impact would this have on the Stockbridge Munsee and other groups? What kind of numbers are we talking about, according to the report?
It's about $37 million in total, and $22 million of that comes from the Stockbridge-Munsee community. That is a large chunk. Stockbridge is a very big partner in Shawano County. We are the largest employer in Shawano County, and we do a lot of support. We do a lot of the law enforcement on the western side of the county. We spend as much or more on Shawano County roads as the county does itself, and those partnership opportunities and those improvements are in danger when that kind of impact hits our main revenue source.
You described this expansion of the Ho-Chunk facility in Wittenberg as unlawful. There was a change in the charter, the agreement, the compact between the state and tribes along these ancillary facilities. As Governor Walker and some other state officials have said, as far as they can tell within the law, there's nothing they could do to stop this from happening. Is it really unlawful, and why?
It is. The 2003 amendments done by Governor Doyle did allow more ancillary facilities in the state for Ho-Chunk, but it was consistent on three limitations to ensure that ancillary facilities were different from full gaming facilities. One, the facility has to be all one building. Two, the non-gaming portion or the C-store part of the business had to generate more revenue than the casino side of the ancillary facility. And three, the C-store side of the business had to be physically larger than the slot side of the business. If you go to the Wittenberg facility now, you will see it violates all three of those provisions. There are two separate buildings. It has currently 500 slot machines, which is almost as many machines as many of the casinos in the northern area of Wisconsin. And there is no way that 500 slot machines don't produce more revenue than gas, diesel, cigarettes, and candy bars.
Talking to Dennis Puz, general counsel for the Stockbridge Muncie band of Mohican Indians, talking about an economic impact study of a Ho-Chunk casino facility expansion in Wittenberg. The study found a major negative economic impact on other tribal casinos, mainly theirs, in that region. This is likely going to the courts, but what would you like to see before courts are involved from the state?
Well, we have specifically asked the state to enlist outside counsel, just as they did for the Kenosha application when there are multiple tribes with different viewpoints and issues with that application and that casino project. It only makes sense for them to engage an Indian gaming expert and bring them to the table to help advise the state on the proper interpretation of the compact. We have done that. We've brought in outside experts, nationally known Indian law experts, to review our argument and to help us on this issue. We're just asking the state to do the same.
But would you hope for the state to force the Ho-Chunk, if possible, to reduce the size of this Wittenberg facility?
Well, the state has a duty under the compact to enforce them. And with the interpretation of the three limitations that exist in the compacts now for ancillary facilities for the Ho-Chunk Nation, the state has a duty to enforce those. And we hope with an outside attorney advising them on the proper interpretation of the compact, they will step forward, regulate Indian gaming in Wisconsin as they're supposed to, and enforce the compact.
Supposing that doesn't happen, and the governor, again, and the Department of Administration in the past have said they can't do anything, what would be the next step for you?
All options are on the table. If the state fails to move forward and enforce the compacts, we have to look at all options available to us under the compacts. There's multiple dispute resolution processes available, arbitration, mediation. Lawsuits are also available, and we are exploring all options because we cannot allow an illegal casino expansion to occur and have this kind of impact on the community.
Is there precedent for this kind of challenge, or are we in kind of uncharted territory with that 2003 compact revision and these ancillary facilities?
Well, there's one other argument about the Ho-Chunk Wittenberg expansion. The land has to be eligible under federal law for gaming to occur there. There are open questions about whether the land in Wittenberg is actually eligible for gaming under the federal Indian law, IGRA, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 88. There is precedent in the state, actually against Stockbridge Muncie. In the late 90s, Stockbridge put gaming machines at its golf course, which it believed to be within the reservation boundaries and eligible for gaming. The state disagreed, and issued an injunction and litigated for 6 years over that issue and ultimately won on that issue. So there is direct precedent against my client where the state took action on these issues and enforced the compact and enforced their interpretation. We're just asking for the same treatment here.
If this doesn't happen, if things stay as they are with this expansion, can you talk about what this economic impact would mean down the road for the Stockbridge-Muncie Band?
Well, obviously, we went to the public with this information shortly after we received it. We are still processing what this means for us internally. We still hold out hope that the state will step up and enforce the compacts. If they don't, we have to explore all options to force enforcement and look at what impacts that means for us. Obviously, like any government, when there's a reduction in revenue, there needs to be streamlining, there needs to be a new approach taken. And we will also gear up and compete as hard as we can at our facility to give consumers a better choice.
Does there need to be fundamentally a revision in the compacts themselves, or is this just a matter of the enforcement of the compacts that we have?
This is simply a matter of enforcement. We have no issue with Ho-Chunk operating all the gaming it is legally allowed to operate. But when they go and build gaming that exceeds what's allowed in the compact and then propose to expand even further, that's where we have issue. There is no need for compact reform. There's only a need for compact enforcement.
Dennis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dennis Puz. He's the Stockbridge-Muncie General Counsel. He joined us to tell us why plans to expand a Ho-Chunk casino in Wittenberg have some other tribes worried about their economic futures.
Coming up, Oscar nominations are out, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The contenders were announced this week, and Golden Globes were awarded earlier in the month, and we want to know what movie or film performance stood out for you in 2016, whether or not it got a nod from Oscar. So if you decide the winners and losers, who would you pick for the 2016 movies and actors? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And have you seen a lot of the Oscar contenders, or are you like me and you've seen, oh yeah, I saw that one and keep meaning to see the others? Are there ones on your to-watch list when you get around to it? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back in just a minute to take your calls here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. The Golden Globes were awarded earlier this month, and Oscar nominations came out earlier this week. And now we want to hear from you. What movies and film performances are at the top of your list from 2016? Call in now at 800-642-1234.
What movie did you tell everybody they just had to go see? Or was there one that you thought was maybe overhyped, wanted to tell people, don't go, don't waste your time and money? We want to hear either of those at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Straight to your calls now. Gail is on the line in Chicago. Gail, hi.
How are y'all?
Good. What is your movie, Gail?
Moonlight.
Moonlight, that is one of the nominees, one of the many nominees I didn't see. Tell us a little bit about Moonlight and what you liked about it.
Do not pass go. Do not sleep tonight until you go see this film. I think this is an important film. I actually, one of the last ones that I had to see was La La Land. I saw it yesterday. I thought it was an excellent film. But I think that Moonlight is an important film. And I think that it's important that filmgoers go to a theater, spend their money, vote with their dollar, and show Barry Jenkins. We love his work. He's an amazing artist. This is a true independent film. I think the budget was $5 million, which is mind-blowing. Still an amount of money. But it's such a beautifully told story. The cinematography is amazing. And it's a topic that we don't talk much about. Gay black men. You know, it's not an area that is really discussed much. And the more that we bring these things to light, the less that they're taboo and the more that we understand that these are all part of who we are. And I think it's an amazing film, and I can't talk about it enough.
Gail, thank you so much. Obviously very enthusiastic. Are you going to go back and see it again? Is this one you think will reward rewatching?
I absolutely do. So I've got a couple others to see, and then I'm going to probably book it with this one.
Gail, thanks a lot. Gail, two big thumbs up there for Moonlight.
Wow.
Okay, I've got to get that up on my priority list.
Yeah, she was selling me on it.
Definitely.
I haven't seen it, but yeah, that's a really passionate vote there from Gail. And let's go next to Fawn, who's sharing her pick for best movie, best performance, movie she had to tell everybody about at 800-642-1234. And Fawn joins us from Madison. Fawn, hi.
Hi, great. Thank you very much. And I agree. My pick, I have to say, much like the last caller, this is an important movie. It's also a very good movie. Hidden Figures. I don't see many movies, but this is one that was outstanding. I've seen a few of the group that was nominated. But Hidden Figures, it's a phenomenal story. It's well written. It's excellently acted. And it's heartwarming. It's just something that it keeps you on kind of on the edge of your seat, even though there's no sex, no violence, no sexism. It's hard to, you know, like, it's one of those wonderful movies I love seeing come out of Hollywood. Arrival was another one in that regard, but there was no nudity, no objectification of women, and it showed women in a positive light doing scientific and, you know, very ingenious things, although that was a fiction. This is nonfiction, and it shows women doing things that are important to American history that are indeed have been hidden from us, and most people would never know unless you see this film. It's so uplifting. The gals in the movie theater who are staffing it agreed that this should be shown in every high school in America. It should be part of the curriculum to show what can be done. And women who just without a second thought, they excel in mathematics, engineering, and computer science. That's who they are. And that they did this against so many odds.
That's terrific. Yeah, that's actually at the very top of my list of movies
I
want to see.
Seen,
it's
yeah.
on my list for this weekend. Also, La La Land is one that's on my list to see. But it's so great hearing these passionate endorsements of these movies, and it encourages me to get out there and see them. So, Fawn, thank you so much for recommending Hidden Figures.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. Oscar nominations are out, and we want to hear your picks. If the Academy gave you votes for Best Picture, Best Performances, want to hear who you would recommend, or just what movie you've seen in the last year that you are recommending Oscar-worthy or not. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Oh, wanted to mention, we talked to the author of the book, Hidden Figures, that the movie was based on here on Central Time, so you can go back at the WPR.org archives, hear more about that amazing story. And you can call in now, 800-642-1234.
Well, here's one that I did see, and of course, it's a children's film, because that's what I tend to see. But I thought it was really good, and I didn't hear a lot about it. I didn't hear people buzzing about it that you do about some of the big Disney blockbusters like, you know, Beauty and the Beast, some of those older ones that are Frozen that got a lot of talk. But I really liked Moana.
I didn't see that. Yeah. My kids have aged out of that a little bit.
I don't
bit.
Think you ever age out. You never age out of. No. No, they're really good. And Lin-Manuel Miranda collaborated on the music there, and you could hear it. I felt like you could hear little bits of Hamilton in the music of Moana, and it was just great. And, you know, we go around singing some of the songs. It was really good.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. Caller who just dropped off the line mentioned the movie Lion. Here's a list of the Best Picture nominees, by the way. Arrival, one of our callers mentioned. Fences, Hacksaw Ridge was a war movie. Mel Gibson directed that one. People were surprised about that. He was kind of on the outs with Hollywood for a while. Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures we've heard about. La La Land, a lot of people are loving that. Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and of course Moonlight we heard about.
Right, and we've had one of our film critics on who liked a lot of those. Manchester by the Sea, I know, was one that people are talking a lot about too. Charles joins us right now in Milwaukee. Charles, hi.
Hi, I'm calling in from Milwaukee, and I saw Hidden Figures last weekend, and I'd vote for that. It's a great history piece and a great civil rights piece, and it's just very much timely right now, considering the Women's March in Washington and the whole issues around women. So lots of kudos to Hidden Figures.
And Charles, you really like that one. Have you seen any of the others that are on the list?
I don't think I have yet. But I really like Hidden Figures.
Great. Well, thank you. Another vote for Hidden Figures there from Charles.
800-642-1234 is the number to call with your Oscar nominations, your Oscar votes. And back to our callers. Tony is with us in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is your vote, Tony?
My vote goes for Hidden Figures.
Another Hidden Figures.
The greatest movie that I've seen in a long time.
Oh.
I mean, the cast is just great, but the story in itself. You had a caller earlier who talked about, you know, all high school students should see that. I agree with her. It's about our history as a country, but it's about these black women. And, you know, we've told women for the longest, you're not good in math, you're not good in science, go over here and do something like this. But it shows the exact opposite. They are good in math. They are good in science. Just a great movie.
And, Tony, I wanted to ask one thing people pointed out. Pharrell Williams did the music, great music. I thought it stood out. That did not get a nomination. Do you think it should have?
I thought it should have, but, you know, I didn't think that much about him in the nomination. I was just thinking about the actors and the story and the fact that, you know, until this movie came out, we never knew anything about this, about these individuals, about, you know, what their contribution had been. And it's like, wait a minute, where has this been? Again, it goes back to the point where we really do need to have stories made about everybody and how this country is so great.
Tony, thanks a lot for that call. If Central Time listeners were voting on Oscars, I think Hidden Figures would be a lock. Still time for your votes for the best movie or best performance. 800-642-1234 is the number.
And we go next to Michael joining us in Appleton. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
What did you want to vote for?
I actually, a suggestion for you, especially if you mostly watch kids' movies, Kubo and the Two Strings.
I've seen it, and it's really good.
It is. Yeah, not a lot of people did because it's the smaller production company. But, yeah, the music and the visuals are all really, really excellent. The voice acting. Matthew McConaughey is in it, I think, which is funny to me. But that was really excellent. I think that got 2 Oscar nominations.
I thought that was really startling. It was like a children's film that I'd never seen before. Maybe the storyline, it felt unfamiliar and really beautiful. I guess that's how I'd phrase it. What do you think?
Yeah, well, it's the smaller production company, Leica, or I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but they do, you know, only the stop motion films, and then based it on, you know, it has the sort of Japanese elements in the story and obviously visually and everything like that. But, you know, just the whole stop motion with CGI for some of the backgrounds and other things, it's really sort of unusual. And we went into it not totally knowing what to expect, but we're really all left the theater really pleased.
Yeah, same here. Well, thank you for bringing that up, Michael. That's a good one. Another in the family-friendly genre. But I'm going to say I think it would appeal to grown-ups, too, definitely. That one had a lot of intensity, actually. And it was startling and beautiful. I will stand by that. But I will see Michael's Kubo and the Two Strings and also mention the BFG, the Big Friendly Giant, came out. And I thought that was also fantastic. I really liked that one. It was really beautiful.
Was that animated as well?
It was not animated.
Okay.
I think. Wow, isn't that funny? I can't remember. I don't think it was animated.
If it was animated, it was so realistic.
It was not animated.
Okay.
There, I'm going to say it. But it was great.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I was going to say, I keep hearing about this Kubo and the Two Strings movie, and I realize I keep hearing about it from you.
I don't think I talk about it that much.
Well, no, but at the time, you were really into it.
Right.
And,
no,
and some of our movie critic guests were big on that, too. And that was nominated for Best Animated Feature, I think. I don't have that in front of me right now. It is definitely on the Oscar nomination list. Okay, so we've seen the lists. We've heard from some of our listeners here. What's on your list? If you can get out to see a movie this weekend, what are you going to try to do?
Well, now I'm torn. I was going to go see La La Land. That is definitely on my list this weekend.
A lot of people talking about
that. But now there's been so many votes here for Hidden Figures. Now I'm torn. I don't know which one to go see. Probably whatever one there's still tickets for.
Well, true. Hidden Figures, I have seen. Moonlight, I hadn't heard much about. That our first caller was really into that. Maybe that is one I should give a shot to. I might have time this weekend. Might get out there. I think I saw more blockbuster-type stuff this year than Oscar-type movies.
Right, and one of my, you know, probably shortfalls is that I'm a movie wimp. If it's too intense, if it's too tragic, sometimes I have a hard time with that.
I
used to go see all the most tragic films that I could find, and now I go see kids' movies, basically. But I think I'm going to break that. I'm going to bust out and see something.
Well, if you have an Oscar-nominated favorite that you want to cast your vote for, you can still do that. You can tweet us, at Central Time WPR, or post on the Central Time Facebook page, and hey, maybe nudge me and Veronica toward a movie to see. Wisconsin sports fans have been in the market for some good news after Sunday and the very not fun Packers playoff loss.
And that news came yesterday from the world of college basketball. At the UW-Madison, the Badgers beat Penn State for the 18th straight win at home. The Badgers came in ranked 15th in the country.
And maybe a bigger story, Marquette, it hadn't been ranked at all, maybe unfairly, some people thought. Maybe they're on the edge of maybe making it into the big NCAA tournament. They beat Villanova, which is the number one ranked team on the AP list. They beat them 74-72. So that puts Marquette back on the map this year, maybe a shot at making the cut for the NCAA tournament. Now, all my watching tends to go toward pro football, but there's exciting stuff happening in Wisconsin in college basketball.
Yeah, Wisconsin's a great sports town, and it seems like there's always something exciting happening. Even if, you know, the Packers lose, that's the headline. But there's a lot of great teams. I'm a Brewers person. I'm used to despair and failure, and yeah. I still love the Brewers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's fun to keep. And the Bucks, I've seen them through some bad times there, too. But college basketball is one of those, the tournaments I'll watch. Wisconsin, the Badgers runs, and the tournaments lately have been so exciting. Maybe I got to start watching some regular season, set aside time for that. Maybe forget the movies. Oh, no, I got to do both. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.